Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. As we kick off 2021, I also wanted to note that this is our 150th episode of Facing the Future. It has been a lot of fun speaking with top policy experts and elected leaders, and thank you for listening week in and week out. With 2020 in the rearview, we press onward and upward. Today, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and former Congressman Tim Penny will join the program to discuss the challenges facing the incoming Biden administration and the new Congress, as well as a recent change to PAYGO standards in the U.S. House and how they could impact policymaking. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that a House rules change exposed an internal rift among Democrats over deficit spending, even as the chamber adopted its rules package this week for the 117th Congress without any party defections. Given Democrats' extremely thin House majority, how the new rules are interpreted could have big implications for getting President-elect Joe Biden's expansive agenda through the chamber, as party moderates are already threatening to oppose big spending packages. The new rules changes adopted on a 217-206 party line vote stipulate that deficit increasing legislation is exempt from rules requiring budgetary offsets as long as the measures are related to the COVID-19 response or climate change. That's a change from past years and a compromise brokered by Democratic leaders between the progressive wing of the party, which wanted pay-as-you-go rules eliminated entirely, and centrist Democrats who wanted to preserve them. The new Congress that was just sworn in will face demands for trillions of dollars in new spending this year as a new president takes office in the throes of a worsening pandemic. President-elect Biden has outlined economic and medical relief plans that could cost more than $3 trillion over the coming decade, according to an estimate from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. That's on top of non-pandemic-related campaign proposals that could cost $5.6 trillion over 10 years, CRFB estimated. The new demands come at a time when federal debt held by the public is already approaching record levels. By fiscal year 2023, even without new spending initiatives, the debt is on track to reach 107% of GDP, its highest level in the nation's history, the Congressional Budget Office said in a recent report. And the coming fiscal battles will be fought in closely divided House and Senate chambers that give neither party much margin for error. This year's appropriation process will get off to a slow start, the Biden transition team warned last week. Under the 1974 budget law that established the modern budget process, the president is required to submit a budget request on the first Monday of February, although there is no penalty for missing the deadline, and the first budget of a new administration is often submitted weeks, if not months, late. Even before reported transition problems, the fiscal year 2022 appropriations process was already shaping up to be a challenge. For the first time since 2011, there will be no statutory spending caps imposed under a deficit reduction law. The House and Senate budget committees, potentially from opposite parties, will need to draft budget resolutions setting discretionary spending limits before appropriators can do their work. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and former Congressman Tim Penny will join me to discuss the challenges facing the incoming Biden administration and the new Congress. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Tim Penny. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Former Congressman Penny represented Minnesota's first congressional district in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1982 to 1994. Previously, he was a member of the Minnesota State Senate. Most recently, he was a senior counselor at a Twin Cities-based public affairs firm and a senior fellow at the Humphrey Institute. Congressman Penny is co-chair of the Economic Club of Minnesota, co-chair of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, and he serves on the board of the Concord Coalition. He has co-authored three books, Common Sense, The 15 Biggest Lies in Politics, and Payment Due. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Congressman Penny.
Good to join you.
Thanks, Chase.
Happy to have you both here, and we're actually in our 150th episode for Facing the Future, and this is the first full week of the new year, so we're officially in 2021, so it's an honor to have you both on the program for this historic Facing the Future episode, and we're talking about the potential challenges that'll be facing President-elect Biden and a new Congress, and so I'll kick it off with what life could be like between now and the midterms for you, Congressman. I know we just had an election. We're already talking about the next one. I guess that's what politics is like these days. But what do you see as the biggest economic and policy challenges facing this new Congress and a Biden administration?
Well, I'm going to start with COVID-related stimulus spending. There's going to be a lot of pressure on Biden to put together another package, much bigger than any that we previously considered. I think he needs to resist that pressure, largely because what was just enacted by the Congress with the additional dollars for the unemployed and additional dollars to help businesses hang on to their employees until hopefully a few months down the line we're opening up the economy again. I think we basically dealt with what's the most urgent under these circumstances. Another package, if you take a look at what the Democrats proposed way back in May, would likely include all sorts of items that are unrelated to the COVID challenge. Result in spending on a whole host of activities, bailing out state governments, padding budgets for school districts that really are not directly related to the needs that exist. I used to be a Democrat, so I know that they like to spend money and take every opportunity to do so. But I'm afraid another package will be way too big and not targeted at all. So that would be, I think, his first challenge. Beyond that, though, we do have lingering unemployment challenges. Certain sectors of our economy have struggled mightily, the entertainment sector, the recreation sector, the hospitality sector. And a lot of those aren't going to come back as quickly as we would like. Many of those businesses have failed and will not be reopening. And the workers in those industries need specific attention. Most other folks are going to find their way back into the workforce. But in those areas, the jobs are not plentiful. And there needs to be some thought given to how do we retrain or assist those folks until they can find suitable employment. So those are two thoughts that come to mind.
And Congressman, I'm sure Bob has some pointed questions on this topic as well. But before I kick it over to him, one question I had, it sounds like you see a clear distinction between emergency response and then what would likely be considered economic stimulus that would help certain industries and help get the economy and the workforce back up on its feet. What do you see as policies that Congress should be pursuing to encourage more long-term economic growth, especially as we come out of this dramatic dip that we saw in 2020?
As I mentioned a moment ago, I really think some targeted assistance for those employment sectors that are the hardest hit and least likely to come back in a robust way. More broadly, especially now that we have a vaccine available and more of those the vaccines will be distributed in the coming months, the sooner we can reopen the economy in a wholesale way, the better. And that needs to be a priority for this administration. I think longer term investments would certainly include infrastructure, but I think there's a way to do that properly paid for. And I think for the most part, our government policy, especially in this post-pandemic era, in which we have ballooned the debt by several trillion dollars, needs to return to a pay-as-you-go approach. And so there are investments we could make, and I'm sure this administration has some ideas along those lines, but they should not be made in a fiscally irresponsible way by adding even more to our deficits and debt. And what I worry about is that even if, and it's a big if, Biden succeeds in convincing Congress to repeal the tax cuts enacted by Trump and the Republicans in the recent past, he's only going to do that for the highest income earners. He's only going to do that on corporate tax rates. And when you add up all the taxes he could secure with those policies, it's about a third of what he has promised to spend. And so I think it's going to be a real challenge for this administration to present a budget that's fiscally responsible, because their proposed tax increases are well short of their promised spending increases.
You introduced a subject that I want to delve into a little bit more, and that's PAYGO, pay as you go, which was a rule that really came out of the 1990s, and it was one of the great budget innovations of the time that helped us address our deficits and debt at that point. There's, as you mentioned, there's a it's going to be very, very difficult for President Biden to enact any sort of an agenda that he ran on and maintain PAYGO, because a lot of it is relies on large deficit spending. And you know, recently the Democrats that came in the House, establishing the new leadership in the House, have a rule change to PAYGO that would allow for exception. They do maintain PAYGO. And then perhaps have exceptions that swallow the rule. One, which I think everybody supports, is for what would be, you know, unquestioned pandemic relief. Nobody thinks that emergencies, particularly something as dire as this, would be needed to be paid for. But then you get into the broader questions of investments, and the new leadership would amend PAYGO to exempt climate change, anything designed to address climate change, which is a, as you know, I mean, that can be it's a legitimate problem. It's a huge subject matter. I mean, you have infrastructure bills, healthcare bills, it's just about any, you can declare that it affects the climate. And, you know, I'm not by any means being a climate denier here, but I think that you can have a rule like PAYGO, and then it's how you define it that's important. And just if you could reflect on that a little bit.
Well, you know, this is where the old rules are sometimes the right rules. The way we defined this in its early stages back in the early 1990s, was pretty effective. I mean, it really did prohibit moving forward with any legislation that wasn't appropriately offset with spending. Any spending increases had to be effectively offset by other spending reductions or by new revenues. Any tax legislation had to be deficit neutral. One of the factors in achieving a balanced budget by the end of the 1990s was, of course, the growing economy. But a piece of that was also spending restraint. And that spending restraint was accomplished by the kind of rules we put in place then, because it was not riddled with loopholes. Once we got into the 2000s, we ran into some difficulty because in a bipartisan fashion, Congress decided that contingency costs for the military operations in the Middle East should not be subject to PAYGO. And that began to open the door for all sorts of additional spending. And so PAYGO works when exceptions aren't in play. And it will never work as long as there are exceptions, because one exception leads to another.
I wanted to just pick up on that and extend it out a little bit here on the political dynamic of the two sides having to work together. I was heartened by the effort, both in the House and the Senate, from Democrats and Republicans to come together on the last COVID relief bill, which was just passed and ultimately signed just after Christmas, I guess. But that really was spearheaded. It bubbled up generically from Democrats, from the leadership, but from a bipartisan coalition that kind of almost forced the leadership to address the issue. And eventually the negotiation process took place. Do you think that that's a potential model in the coming Congress, because the margins are going to be so close in both houses?
Yeah, I do, and that was a hopeful development. They still ended up with a carte blanche check for every American, which I think was unnecessary. If people are still working, they're not in need of an extra check. But it was much, much smaller than what had been proposed earlier and what had been insisted upon by the president himself. So there are more modest supplement to unemployment insurance. Their recommendation around the Paycheck Protection Program and restoring that so that more businesses could benefit from that and keep their employees on the payroll, I think was masterful, and it moved us off the opposing sides that had maintained for almost 6 months, with the Democrats looking for $3 trillion of spending, much of which had nothing to do with the immediate crisis, and the Republicans really lowballing it at the other end. They found a sensible middle ground. As you recall, and as most of your listeners would not recall, when I was in Congress along with Charlie Stenholm and others, I was the leader of a faction of Democrats numbering roughly 55-60 members of the caucus who were more fiscally conservative. Because the Democrats had larger majorities back in those days, it was important that a group of about that size be brought together around fiscal issues in order to kind of pull things back to the sensible center. Now, with much, much narrower majorities in both chambers, it doesn't require a group of 50 or 60. Five or six can make the difference if they are stalwart and if they are courageous enough to stand up to the pressures. So I do have some optimism that in this closely divided Congress, a small group of moderate, centrist, fiscally conservative legislators can have a hugely important role.
Didn't you do some budgets with some guy named Kasich? Was that his name?
Yeah, there was this Republican, John Kasich, who was the ranking Republican on the budget committee. And so he and I put together a package that did not pass. I will acknowledge the fact. But it came so close to passing that I think it continued to keep the pressure on the institution as a whole to hew a little closer to the fiscal line.
And Congressman, I want to stay in this vein of bipartisanship for a little bit longer before we move to a new topic. And you mentioned a bit about what your time was like in Congress. I'm curious, from your view, how has, in this incredibly partisan environment, how has policymaking changed since when you were in office to now? And I guess a quick follow-on to that is this small group that bubbled up sort of at random to help push through bipartisan COVID relief. Does that give you hope for perhaps a mending of some of our ideological divides, or do you think it's more kind of a one-off because of the nature of things right now?
Well, I don't think it's a one-off, mostly because the margin is so tight that I can't imagine legislators like Manchin, legislators like Sass, knowing that just a couple votes can decide what happens in their chamber, backing off and just folding in with the rest of their party. And I really have difficulty seeing how they're just going to go along, because the parties are so far apart that the only folks that can bridge that divide are this handful of moderates in both caucuses. And I think this applies to fiscal issues. It applies to immigration. It applies to some of our trade issues. It applies to issues like infrastructure. All of those issues, you can find enormous differences between the bulk of the members in both caucuses, but neither of them have enough votes to pass their legislation unless they can secure the middle. So I think it gives them significant influence if they're willing to step up and play that role.
And we happen to be recording on election day in Georgia, so we don't know the results yet of the runoff elections and what the final makeup of the Senate will be. It'll either be a maintaining Republican majority or potentially a 50-50 split. Does that really matter for policymaking purposes for a Biden administration? Or to your point, is because that margin would be so thin, you're going to need swing votes either way. And so the agenda will probably come out to be about the same.
Yeah, this could be a godsend for Biden, is that the close division in both chambers could allow him to stand up to the left of his own party and to say that in this environment, you know, half a loaf is the best we can do. And of course, you've got the problem solvers group in the House, which is similar to this bipartisan group that's emerged in the Senate. They could really be the deciding factor on issue after issue. And Biden would be wise to really court that group in both chambers and empower them to get, it's not going to give him everything that the more partisan, more left-leaning members of his caucus would want, but it will get him something as opposed to nothing. And you would think Biden, having aspired to the presidency for decades now, would want to have a presidency that actually got things done.
So, and I'll kick it to Bob in just 1 second, another follow-up for you, Congressman, is, do you think we're entering a period where we see progress on issues or more gridlock? I see this tug of war that you're describing between the far left and the far right and the need for the middle to step up and, I guess, play a power broker role basically in this legislature. But does that mean we're going to see more gridlock, or do you think we get action on key issues?
Well, I think, unfortunately, there's perhaps a majority in both caucuses on Capitol Hill in both chambers that don't mind gridlock because it serves their political purposes, their political agenda. But the Problem Solvers Caucus, the bipartisan group in the Senate, are in a unique position to sort of show a way forward. It doesn't mean they'll succeed, but I think it's hard for me to believe that even if they suspend the filibuster rules in the Senate and try to pass legislation on a 50-vote margin with the vice president being the deciding factor, and that could be the scenario if the Democrats pick up both of those Georgia seats. I don't see the two or three more moderate to conservative Democrats that they need to make that happen going along, and even getting rid of the filibuster. It's hard for me to see those two or three moderate to conservative Democrats saying, yes, we want to break up the filibuster and allow one party rule. So I'm cautiously optimistic that that in this environment, the center can show the way. And I'm cautiously optimistic that if Biden actually wants to get anything done, as opposed to just presiding over four wasted years, that he will understand that math and try to pursue that pathway.
Kim, one of the things that and I'm hopeful that there are people that actually want to get something done. That is a prerequisite. One of the things that's different, very, very different from when you were in Congress and even in when Concord was doing a fiscal wake-up tour until fairly recently, is that there was a consensus on both sides that deficits mattered. Yeah. The difference was over what you do about them or maybe how quickly you deal with them or that sort of thing. But now there's a lot more sentiment, saying, well, we really don't need to worry about it at all. And, Republicans pushed that with their last tax cut, which, paid no attention to the deficit. And Biden has a very large agenda. And a lot of Democrats, economists and others are saying, well, why should we worry about deficits? And it really is a different environment, because then there are like no rules and no need to impose rules. And I'm just wondering, you certainly have been a business friendly Democrat over the years. Is that attitude, do you, is that just a Washington thing, or do you feel that seeping out beyond the Beltway into the business community of the folks that you deal with? I mean, is there a feeling that, well, Washington shouldn't worry about deficits anymore? Yeah.
No, I think in the business sector, there's always a concern, because in the business sector, you've got to watch the bottom line. And they also think long term about where's the economy going to be in the future. And they do worry about all this debt hanging over our economy and servicing that debt. We have a certain amount of that debt owned by foreign investors that don't necessarily have America's best interest at heart. And so there are these worrisome signs, but that's the business community. I think in the broader public, a strong contingent in both political parties are of the view that we want what we want and we want to get what we want. The base in both parties are not as focused on this issue as they maybe once were. I think in the 1990s, and maybe it was the Pearl Factor, but even preceding that, during the time that I was in Congress, there was always some sense that we couldn't get carried away with debt. Deficits were much smaller then, but they were always an annual worry. The most alarming thing to me is that this election, 2020, we didn't have either presidential candidate even giving lip service to the deficit and debt. And I can't remember it being a non-issue in any previous presidential election. And that worries me, because I think it does reflect that within the base of both major parties, the candidate for the president didn't feel they even needed to speak to the issue. That doesn't bode well. But I'll go back to my more hopeful comments earlier that Biden's a long-time resident of Washington, D.C. He's waited a long time to secure the presidency. I can't believe he wants to sit there for 4 years and get nothing done. And in order to get something done, I think he has to be somewhat responsive to fiscal issues, because he can't do it all with the tax increases that he's proposed. And he can't get anything done on Capitol Hill if he tries to pursue a strict party line approach.
And Congressman, you talked about, or we've all talked about, how deficits were smaller in the 80s and 90s relative to today. And how it may even be unrealistic, maybe in my mind especially, to balance the budget right now or even right away, given that we're at a $3 trillion deficit. You talked about trying to abide by PAYGO, you know, ensuring that any emergency response doesn't make our long-term fiscal policy or fiscal standing worse. So I guess the question that I have is, given how dramatic the numbers are today, how different they are from when we last even had a balanced budget, what does fiscal responsibility look like today? When you're talking to the base of a party or policymakers, you know, what should be the vantage point of what's considered fiscal responsibility?
Well, I'll borrow from my friend Charlie Stenholm, with whom I overlapped in Congress, and he and I continue to be involved with both Concord and the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. And he has said hundreds of times over the years, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. So I think we're maybe in an environment where that's the best we can do right now, at least for the immediate future. Obviously, we know at Concord and at the Committee for Responsible Budget that that longer-term challenges like Medicare insolvency and Social Security insolvency are in need of serious attention. But at the very least, in the current climate, the best thing to do is to just stop digging the hole deeper, and that's where pay-as-you-go and other important policies come into play. That's where bipartisan centrist groups in both chambers need to understand the power and the influence they have in this moment with narrow majorities in both chambers to really assert themselves and to help put the brakes on.
And one final question before we go, Congressman. It's a great point to encourage policymakers to not dig the hole any deeper. We've got, you know, theories and policies like modern monetary theory now coming into the conversation and encouraging policymakers to not worry about the size of the hole. So when we're making that plea, that request to not dig the hole deeper, you know, what's the reasoning for it? Is it a generational perspective, not wanting to pass a larger burden on to, say, me or now my one-year-old son? Or is it more economically focused? How do you package that argument to encourage policymakers to not veer so far off and care about the size of the hole?
I think it's near term and long term. I think in the long term, of course, it's the economic consequence of huge debt and how that can just consume us going forward. I think near term, it's the crowding out argument that as the debt grows, the interest costs grow. As the interest costs go and they must be paid, that reduces the money on the table for anything else. And so I think it's a two-part argument where we need to focus on the near term in terms of the crowding out that interest payments on the debt create and make it much more difficult to do anything else that the government is supposed to do. But then the longer term argument is when this debt problem, which is now, you know, exceeding the size of our economy, you know, at some point you got to pay the piper. And we know that day is coming.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and former Congressman Tim Penny discuss challenges facing President-elect Biden and the new Congress as we begin a new year, as well as the importance of long-term fiscal responsibility. Thank you for joining Facing the Future, Congressman.
Thank you.
In the next segment, Bob will return to discuss some recent rule changes in the House that concern PAYGO. We're back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show once again by Bob Bixby. Bob is Concord's executive director, a regular contributor on the show. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks, Chase.
Happy to have you back in 2021, and we're discussing what might seem like a little bit of a granular issue, but it could have broad sweeping implications on policy moving forward, and that is a recent rule change in the U.S. House of Representatives relative to PAYGO. And before we jump into what that rule change was, I just want to cover a couple general bases here and ask you, what is PAYGO and when does it apply?
Yeah, PAYGO stands for pay as you go. And it was a concept that came out of budget reforms from the 90s. And it basically said, if you're going to add to mandatory spending, those are the, some call them entitlement programs. They're the ones that run on autopilot that don't go through the regular appropriations process. And that is the bulk of the federal budget. I mean, over 50% of the federal budget is on autopilot. And so it's the entitlement programs and net interest on the debt. And so the rule is that if you're going to add to that, you need to offset it somehow with a mandatory spending cut or a revenue increase, a tax increase. Now, automatic increases don't count under PAYGO. That is to say, Social Security is going to cost more next year than it did last year. And that's true because there are more of us baby boomers retiring. And so it automatically goes up in cost. That's not covered by PAYGO. That automatic cost is going to happen. It's like if Congress wanted to pass a new rule and enhance Social Security benefits or Medicare or anything and create a new entitlement program, it would have to, under PAYGO, find some way to pay for that by either cutting other spending or raising revenue. The same thing is true on the revenue side. If you're going to cut taxes, the rule was that you needed to cut spending by a similar amount or raise some other revenue somewhere else in the tax code. So the idea was that revenue and mandatory spending should be deficit neutral. So it does not apply to discretionary spending. The 12 annual appropriations bills that go through Congress, you deal with those by budget caps if you want to do something. But PAYGO does not apply to those, that part of the budget, which is about a third of the budget.
And one more question before we talk about this current change. Is PAYGO, can it be easily ignored or set aside historically? So are there exceptions built into the rule?
Well, a lot of things can be easily ignored in the House. you know, the Rules Committee in the House is very powerful, and they write a rule for a bill to come to the floor for a vote. And, you know, they can waive PAYGO. So it's... There are a lot of procedural things people can object to that, you know, on the floor and try to bring a point of order. But you know, you really in the House, it's relatively easy for the majority to get its way by waiving rules. It's more difficult in the Senate, but we're talking about the House here. It's an important standard, but. If there isn't a willingness to enforce it, it won't be enforced.
All right. So let's talk about this particular change. I'm assuming I think it's an exception or a couple exceptions to the rule that would bypass any process needed to waive PAYGO?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to define what PAYGO is going to apply to. And in this current environment, the new House rule makes it clear that PAYGO should not apply to things that are enacted to address the pandemic, emergency spending. That's something that I think is pretty much universally accepted, even by advocates of PAYGO, that you don't need to spend for something that's intended to address, you don't need to pay for something that is intended to address an emergency. Another matter that came in, another exception, and this is new, is something that's intended to address climate change. And that's much more amorphous. And I think as a matter of looking at PAYGO, that could be such an enormous exception that it would really swallow the rule. So if you could connect anything to the economic effect or budgetary effect of climate change, gee, there's a lot of things that would fall into that category that could then be exempted. So I think it'll be very, very important to see how that is interpreted. Obviously, the progressive wing in the House side is the Democratic caucus is going to interpret it very, very broadly to have an exception for new things that they want to do, such as a Green New Deal, for example. on the more conservative side, and the House Blue Dog Democrats already have sent out a letter saying that they had some concerns about this and they would want to interpret that rule very strictly, that climate change is a real problem, but it's something that that we, you know, ought to be careful about having a blanket exception for PAYGO.
So, Bob, I'm trying to think of what types of programs would fall into these exceptions beyond just the topics. So can you maybe give a general example or type of program that would be considered mandatory spending and also part of emergency response?
Well, a lot of the it's possible that some of the healthcare initiatives, things like food assistance, the SNAP program is considered a mandatory spending. If you went to a system of paid family leave, you know, universal child care, there are things like that that would probably be implemented as mandatory spending. And then the question would come up about whether you wanted to have a source of revenue or cutting other spending to pay for, essentially creating a new entitlement.
And you mentioned that these exceptions, if taken too broadly, and there may be portions of the House, there are members of the House that would push for broad interpretation and how it could potentially swallow the rule. So my question is, do you have any concern that if we see these broad exceptions pushed to their limits, it's really just a half step toward getting rid of measures like PAYGO altogether?
Yeah, I mean, I worry a little bit about having a measure that does include PAYGO, but has such a broad, open-ended exception as for climate change. Because it begs the question, why not other substantive areas that you might want to have exceptions for? And so I really think the question is this sort of the first step in down the road to getting rid of PAYGO altogether or not? And that's, you know, that'll play out over the course of the year.
And if you're making the argument to keep measures like PAYGO in place, what do you say if the House Rules Committee can set aside PAYGO, or now we're getting pretty large exceptions, like why in your mind do you view PAYGO as a positive policy measure in terms of the legislative process?
Well, I mean, you want to have the rule there and it should be an exception. If you're going to set it aside, somebody should be forced to make the case to do it. And, you know, at least run it past, and you get members that can object. And maybe if enough members object, then the rule wouldn't pass on the floor. That's unusual, but I think there's where you've got folks like the Blue Dogs that come in and possibly the Problem Solvers Caucus. If you had an exception, if you had something that was just, you know, waived and the exception was too broad, then you'd have to look at, particularly in this narrow setting in the House, whether there were more conservative members, moderate members of the Democratic Caucus that would object on the House floor. So the Rules Committee can do what they want, but, you know, the rule still has to pass the House before it's effective.
And one final question before we go here, Bob. We've talked a lot about the three T's, legislation being temporary, timely, and targeted. Is PAYGO a measure that helps ensure that, especially when it comes to emergency relief, we can honor the three T's?
Yeah, I think so, because PAYGO doesn't interfere with emergency relief, because most people would say that it should be an exception for emergencies. And yeah, sure, that could be abused as a way around PAYGO to declare things an emergency, but you can have a fight about that. I think that the concept of PAYGO is really to prevent the long-term budget outlook from getting worse than it already would be. Because remember, it's already on autopilot. We've got an unsustainable situation we did before the pandemic hit. And PAYGO doesn't address that. PAYGO is not about cutting spending or raising revenues. It's about preventing spending new spending programs or revenue reductions that would make the situation worse. And I think that that's still very, very important when we look at a post-pandemic economy. And that allows for waiving PAYGO for COVID-related emergencies.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby. We discussed a rule change in the U.S. House relative to PAYGO. Thanks for joining the show, Bob.
Thanks.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.